Petersfield's Shine Radio.
This is Talking Books, presented by Susie Wild and Tim O'Kelly.
Slightly unusual Talking Books this month. I'm Susie Wild and I'm sitting in my kitchen.
And very nice it is too. I'm Tim O'Kelly from One Tree Books.
And it's excellent. Tim is so kind enough to have come out because regular listeners will know that our dear puppy Paddy has had an operation and is not to be left unguarded in case he licks his wounds. So we'll press on, but that's why it's a bit echoey in here. So what have you been up to, Tim? You've had some major events.
Well, we've had, I've been, World Book Day, just been, and so that was really good. I went to a school, and Sally went to another school, and we've been spreading ourselves quite thinly around the place, and had some really good fun, actually. I had an author, and more from her later. I managed to have an interview with...
Frances Harding.
Frances Harding, indeed.
Her of the Black Cat.
Absolutely. So that was fantastic.
And what about Julia Donaldson?
So we had a lovely time with Julia at Chichester Theatre.
Oh, wow.
She puts on a show called Gruffalo and Friends, and it was amazing. She takes part in the show, and then she spends an hour and a half signing books.
Oh.
Meanwhile, her husband, who's also... Not a young person like Julia, stands there and plays guitar and sings the songs from the show. Just amazing.
Is really, he a musician?
Yes, he plays guitar and he's got a lovely voice.
Oh.
And he stands and sings and entertains the queues while they're waiting. And people wait for up to an hour, an hour and a half to get the book signed because there's so many people there wanting to buy her books. So so we were just the booksellers there and had a lovely day. It's great.
Well, that's brilliant. And very good news for One Tree Books, no doubt.
Absolutely.
Well, excellent. Right, well, I'm going to kick straight into what I'm reading.
What have you been reading, Susie?
I've had a very strange time, so I've already referenced The Puppy. And that's sort of... I'm going to talk about this because everybody will have their own load at some time or another, and sometimes your brain just can't take really heavy fiction or complicated plot or new ways of writing. And so a friend of mine recommended the Devon Mysteries series by Stephanie Austin, who I had never heard of.
No, I haven't come across her before either.
But suddenly, I think she's going to be a sensation because you just, if you look at her on Amazon, let's research her on Amazon, you'll see she's had like 2,000 likes and 4-star reviews, 4- and 5-star reviews for her books. Now, I think it's because I was a bit wary because my pal Linda said to me, I love it because... the writing is transparent, which it is. You get straight into the character and story plot. It is cozy crime, if you like, as a genre. But she writes with literacy. She did an English degree at Bristol Uni. And so it means you're not looking at style. You literally are caught up in these fabulous books. And that's how I came across Ellie Griffiths, because when I had a heart problem and I was in ICU in Chichester, somebody suggested I should try, it was very early, Ellie Griffiths, and it had just the same. It was kind of restorative, it was lovely characters, it was great. So if you're suffering from any problem at the moment, I really recommend these books to you. So they're the Devon Mysteries, there are going to be 8 already. I think she must have had 5 already written, and I've read 3 already. I'm just sort of into them.
Great. I shall make a note, actually, as we speak.
Oh, and, heavens.
Make a note and make sure
and get them
see
in.
I can find if they're available.
See if you can, because Linda could only find them in second-hand bookshops.
Yeah, I don't know if there's not a name I know, so maybe that she's not in the mainstream publishers yet.
Stephanie with an IE, Austin with an IN.
Okay.
So to sort of counter that, Tim, you have talked about The Wager by David Graham.
I have.
For so much. And we both fell upon it because we thought, as Richard and I are both mariners, we'd absolutely love it. And I totally, totally do. But I also want to do it justice. So I reached a point where I thought, I'm going to stop now, when Paddy actually had the operation, because I knew that I would be taken up with that. And I will return to it. But that's going to be my reading.
Well, I think what he does really well, David Grown, he writes non-fiction, but he writes it in a way, in a really good narrative non-fiction. I mean, Thomas Harding of this parish, who writes brilliantly the stories that are true, but that he writes them in such a way that they read like thrillers almost.
Agreed.
And this one is just like that, and it reads a bit like a Patrick O'Brien story.
Yes.
But it's true.
But also, once you get going, one thing I would say, I think Thomas Harding is really good at wearing his research very lightly. So you're really into the characters and the plot at a much earlier stage. So I'd say stick with the David Graham, because there's so much research he's done. Mm-hmm. And loads of people will love that. But I really got going when the plot got going. So how about you?
Well, what have I been reading? I've been reading a book we talked about last time, List of Suspicious Things.
I was reading.
Yeah. And I thought it was pretty good. I'm not giving it an outstanding. I think it's probably aimed at a younger readership. I mean, one of the things, the main protagonist in the book, of whom we from whose point of view we see most of the story, is a young sort of 12-year-old, I think she would be probably 12, 13-year-old, just been to start getting interested in boys, and but I think based on her own experience of growing up, actually, I think it's quite
classic debut novel.
Jenny Goodley, so I think it's really interesting, and but I slightly feel that it is aimed at a probably younger than me readership, probably. And say young adult or 20s.
You see, I disagree. I think it's also very much aimed at those of us who lived through the Yorkshire Ripper thing.
True. Yeah.
And I think that's where it fell down. I think so in a way I agree. I think it didn't really know who its readership was for.
Yes, I think that's right.
It's
partly for these people growing up in the 70s who remember the horrors of the time. And it was probably, it predates me a little bit. But then perhaps if I'd been growing up in Yorkshire, it would have been different. But and I think it's not quite sure what it's doing. I think you're right. So its point of view changes, switches between different characters, which is not problematic in itself, and I don't mind that at all. But again, it means that it lacks a bit of consistency, the feel of the writing. Mm-hmm. Some really good bits of writing, and it confronts issues as well as being written from the point of view of this young person. It confronts obliquely, nicely, issues like racism in Yorkshire at the time, which is still being played out now in the cricketers, the Yorkshire cricketers. It's well done, but I wouldn't say it's a great book.
But you do care about the characters.
We do, and it is definitely worth reading.
Agreed.
So that was the first one I wanted to talk about. Another book, another nautical book I was going to mention, which is Morris and Marilyn. Now, I don't know if you know about this. Someone called Sophie Elmhurst has written this story about these two characters, real people whose story is extraordinary. So in 1973, these two people, Morris and Marilyn, had been married for a few years, and they had decided that they were bored with life and they wanted to do something a little bit different. So they sold their house and they bought a boat and they decided to sail around the world. And all was going really well. They got to sail across the Atlantic, met some really nice people, had a nice time, in the Caribbean, then went through the Panama Canal and into the Pacific. And just, maybe a week out from Panama, a whale decided to pay them a visit.
Oh, is this the whale
and
thing?
The whale just happened to pop up just at the point where they were, which smashed a big hole in their boat.
I know it from a nautical point of view. Right. It's this horrific story because they sank in like 10 minutes or something.
Yes, so it's 1973 and the boat sinks in 10 minutes. So they're throwing all they can, including the log and a few bits and pieces and what food they can find, into a rubber boat, rubber dinghy, before their boat sinks.
Yeah.
And they are in the middle of the Pacific, not quite in the middle of the Pacific, but they're in Pacific, quite a long way from anybody, in quite big seas. And they are there for 118 days.
Don't say too much. So is this not... Did you say it's non-fiction? How is it written?
Non-fiction.
Is it?
So she's written it... So what happened is that they wrote... Really, she... Marilyn wrote quite an extensive diary.
Okay.
When they're actually on board.
Wow.
And about what she was thinking, about what they were doing, what they were catching, how their bodies were deteriorating. And there are two very different characters. Morris is very much a glass half empty character who is sure that they're going to die. And Marilyn is, on the other hand, sure that somebody's going to find them. And the problem is, of course, that this bit of water is populated by the occasional ship, but they are huge. And they're in a tiny little dinghy.
Yeah.
And, of course, unless they practically run them over and it's daylight, middle of the day, they're not going to see them. And anyway, these ships don't have much in the way of lookouts because they're just playing along that...
Soon they're not going to have anyone on board,
no.
Are they?
So it is quite an extraordinary story, and she tells it really well.
Oh, so that's the next question.
Yeah,
it's well told.
She tells it really well.
Okay, I'll look out for that.
And that is just out, actually, that one. So what else have I been reading? I've been reading Old God's Time by Sebastian Barry. Now, this is a tough read. He's a wonderful Irish writer, and the writing is superb. But it's quite a gritty subject. It's priests and sexual abuse, and it doesn't pull any punches, this book, either. So it's
triggering, shall we say.
Well, it's tough. It's a tough read, I would say. But because he writes so brilliantly, it is worthwhile read. Mm. So that's that one, Old God's Time. And the book I'm reading at the moment, actually, this morning I was trying to power through. It's a wonderful book called Crow Lake by Mary Lawson.
Oh, I haven't heard of that.
It's not an author I've come across before. She's a Canadian writer. And this book was written some time ago, but her latest book has just come out, and it prompted me to go back and read this one, because so many people have said to me that she is fabulous.
Say again what it's called.
It's called Crow Lake.
Crow Lake.
And it is, she's a Canadian writer who lives now in Kingston, in London. And it is about a family right at the back of beyond. So they're right, and the Crow Lake is on the end of a road, off a road, off a road. And it's a tiny community of three farms, a school and a church. And it's a mesmerising read, so I would really recommend that. But I haven't quite finished it yet.
Oh, those all good suggestions. So, what exciting books have we got to look out for, Tim?
Okay, well, I've got a number that I'm excited about. Well, one is "You Are Here" by David Nicol. He did One Day. I'm sure you've read that, and I'm sure you've been watching it on Netflix. Which is a perhaps one of the classic modern romantic comedies, but with a twist. Bittersweet, you could certainly say.
Not one of my favourites, I have to say.
Okay. But this is the story of Michael and Mamie. Michael has been abandoned by his wife and sets off walking across the moors, and Mamie's got her own issues, and they obviously meet up. So I haven't read it yet. Looking forward to reading it. So that's one thing that's coming. In coming into paperback is a book called Once Upon a Prime, which is a book about maths and literature, and how they come together.
Non-fiction,
from sonnets to experimental French literature by way of Moby Dick. So it's quite an interesting, I'm looking forward to looking at that properly as well. That's good. The Proms Guide is coming out, the 2024 Proms Guide. Seems to come around very fast every year, but
that's
just a sign of old age, I suspect. But that's always a great seller for us, and people are always interested in what's coming out and learning a bit more about it. And just one other book I wanted to mention, which is a history book that is did really well in hardback, called Revolutionary Spring by Christopher Clark. And it's about 1848 and the year of revolutions in Europe, when all over the continent, things really sprung up and happened. And in, that, in fact, in this country, we didn't have a revolution, as you as you probably know, we didn't there, but we did.
I wasn't alive then. I'm old.
we had the Chartists, and we had all sorts of stuff going on. And while they had a revolution, big revolution in France and Germany and Portugal and all over the place, Italy, they didn't have one here. And why?
But they were frightened we might, weren't
they? Oh, yes. But why didn't we? And they didn't have one in Spain, they didn't have one in Russia. And there are reasons for all those things going on. So that's Revolutionary Spring by Christopher Clark.
Sounds really good. That's exciting. Well, you had such a good interview this month, Tim. I'm really excited about it. And for those of you who don't know, I've already referenced Francis Harding's famous black hat. Yes. So I think most adults got to know her when she wrote The Lie Tree.
Yes, which won the big Costa Prize.
Yeah. Which is voted for by readers, not maybe like you, but certainly like me. But she's been well known amongst all my great friends who are children's authors for years, because she is just the most inventive writer
worlds that go on. Not just one or two, but loads of them. She's sort of created different stories she's made.
She's great. Well, I didn't realise that she actually began her first fantasy novel for children, Fly By Night, was 2005, right, set in an alternative 17th century. So that I didn't know her back then. But I just absolutely love her writing. She's born in Kent, enjoyed a bookish childhood in an isolated old house on a hilltop in the country, I read, and then read English herself at Oxford. Now, I think that's a wonderful background for any writer. So, but tell me, how come? Why were you there? How did you get
to... I was doing an event at a school, and I was providing a bookshop, really, for World Book Day, sort of pop-up bookshop. And she was the author that was there that day. And I said, could he have 10 minutes to have a quick chat? So I grabbed her off and into a classroom
podcast.
And said, yes, for this important podcast. And she was brilliant.
Oh, I'm thrilled to bits. Anyway, here goes Frances Harding.
Okay, so we're very lucky to be joined by Frances Harding today. Frances, you've written this book, Unraveller. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Absolutely. It is a dark fantasy mystery set in an alternative world, an imaginary country called Radith, which at first glance looks like quite a sensible sort of a place, until you notice that along the coast there's a stretch of misty marshwoods that is essentially a fey realm. And part of the weirdness of the wilds, this strip of marshwoods along the coast, leaks into the rest of the country. And one of the main ways it actually affects the country at large is that anybody who is overwhelmed by anger or hatred or intense emotional pain can develop the ability to curse.
Sounds quite a bit dark, is it?
It does go pretty dark. I quite like dark.
Yeah, absolutely. So you came to sort of national prominence, I suppose, with The Lie Tree, which won the Whitby Prize, didn't it? Or was it called the Costa? I can't remember what it was called at that stage.
Yes.
But I'm showing my age there, but rather. That's also on that kind of slightly fey... That sort of fey world, is it? Would you describe it as that, or...?
Well, it is different from Unraveller in the sense that Unraveller is set in an alternative world. A number of my books are, though generally different alternative worlds from each other, whereas The Lie Tree is set in our own past. It's set during the 1860s in our world, but there are some supernatural elements.
Right. So with all these alternative worlds you're creating, do you find that they overlap and you have to work out, remember which world you're in at any one time?
Not usually. They're quite different from each other. So
yeah,
there's not that much bleed through. The thing is, I actually really enjoy creating worlds, and I'm very extravagant with them. I'll come up with lots of elaborate aspects to a world, many of which don't get into the final book because I can't cram it all in. And then I just throw away the world and build another one.
Fantastic. So obviously you've got this obviously amazing imagination that you need to keep on creating, I suppose.
Well, as I say, it's fun.
Fun. Good. And you were telling me earlier about a book you've done in conjunction with Emily Gravett. Tell us a bit about that.
That's the most recent book I've had published. And yes, it is in collaboration with a brilliant award-winning illustrator, Emily Gravett. And this book is called Island of Whispers. This is also set in alternative...
Another world that you've created.
Yes, absolutely.
And is it for a younger audience, or is it...
Not particularly,
I think of her, no. Emily Gravett as being a much younger audience, really. But I mean, her picture books are set for younger people, aren't they?
Yeah, this is definitely for the same sort of age group as my other books. As will probably become clear if I describe it a little. There's an island called Merlang, where when people die, their spirits don't move on, at least not without help. And this is a problem because if anybody catches too distinct a glimpse of a ghost, they can sicken and die. And if ghosts are allowed to wander the island, they can blight the land and cause all kinds of problems. So you have to take great care to secure the dead person's shoes and take them to the local ferryman, because the dead have to follow their shoes. If you don't, the shoes disappear, and then the dead can wander wherever they want. But if you get the shoes to the ferryman, then very occasionally the ferryman will sail out to an island that doesn't appear on any maps and isn't usually there.
Right.
With all these shoes and a number of ghostly passengers to the island of the Broken Tower, where the dead can pass on to whatever awaits them next. So, yes, not your standard picture book. It's a bit deathy.
Right, a bit deathy.
Yes.
Just looking at the front of it, I was looking at the old book of Gabrielle Zevin's called Elsewhere. Did you spot that on the table there? And it's looking at the same... Well, it's about someone dies, and instead of going to some spirit world, they start living their life backwards until eventually they become a newborn baby. But of course, you're acquiring wisdom as you go. So anyway, I mean, I think it's fascinating, this idea of creating a new universes, alternative realities. And I suppose brilliant writers have been doing it for a long time. I mean, who are your big, who would you say, somebody that has inspired you to be a writer?
Oh, there's lots. Or, I think,
or influencers, I suppose. Yeah.
A lot of the writers I read when I was young. So Susan Cooper... Definitely. Her Darkest Rising series had a huge influence on me.
Yeah.
I think she and Alan Garner, between them, gave me a sense of the mythic.
Right. Yeah.
And that's had a lasting effect on my imagination and my sense of place. Leon Garfield was my first encounter with historical fiction. Nicholas Fisk, I loved because he was a supremely unpatronising science fiction writer for children.
Right.
And I think Watership Down was my first epic saga.
Right.
So all of those had a big influence on them.
Yeah, there's another book that's actually, ostensibly it seems quite light, but actually it's quite dark.
Watership Down,
yeah.
Yes.
I think Nice Pretty Little Bunnies, but actually it's not like that at all.
No, it's got the destruction of an entire community, a war, a dictator, punitive mutilation, and two dystopias.
Yes, not... Well, it's been great talking today, Florence. Thanks for taking the time to be with us. And best of luck with the new books.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
So I didn't want to read from the prologue because in a way that's the thing. If you go into One Tree Books, you can just pick up the book and read the prologue for yourself. I wanted to read the bit that made me so glad, even with climate change and everything, to be living now and not then. So the Wager has actually set sail from Portsmouth eventually, and they're carrying aboard something they didn't reckon on. Not long after, they came an invisible siege. Though no guns were fired, many of Bulkley's companions began to collapse as though struck by some malignant force. Boys could no longer muster the energy to climb the masts. The pressed invalids suffered the most, writhing in their hammocks, feverish and sweating, vomiting into pails or on themselves. Some were delirious and had to be watched so that they didn't stumble into the sea. The bacterial bomb of typhus, planted in the ships before they set sail, was now erupting throughout the fleet. "Our men grew distempered and sickly," an officer observed, adding that the fever was beginning to reign among us. At least when the squadron was in England, the infected could be brought ashore to be treated. Now they were trapped on the overcrowded ships. Social distancing, had they even understood the concept, was impossible, and their lice-speckled bodies pressed against unsuspecting new victims. The lice would crawl from one seaman to another, and though their bites weren't dangerous, the traces of faeces they deposited in the resulting wound were laden with bacteria. When a seaman innocently scratched the bite, the louse's saliva made it itch, he became an unwitting participant in his own bodily invasion. The pathogens entered his bloodstream like a stealth boarding party, then spread the contagion from louse to louse and into the lifeblood of the squadron. Bulkley was uncertain how to protect himself, except to devote himself even more intensely to God. The wager's surgeon, Henry Ettrick, set up a sick bay on the lower deck, which had more room to sling hammocks than the operating area in the midshipman's berth. When ailing seamen were shielded below decks from the adverse elements outside, they were said to be under the weather. Ettrick was committed to his patients and a capable knife man, able to amputate a limb in a few minutes. He designed what he called a machine for reducing fractures of the thigh, a 15-pound contraption with a wheel and pinion, which he promised would ensure a patient recovered without limping. Despite such innovations, Ettrick and other doctors of his era had little scientific understanding of disease, and they had no idea how to stop a typhus outbreak. The Centurion schoolmaster, Pasco Thomas, grumbled that Ettrick's theories of infection consisted of a vain flow of words with little or no meaning. Because the concept of germs had not yet emerged, surgical instruments were not sterilised, and paranoia over the source of the epidemic ate at sailors like the disease itself. Did typhus spread through the water or through dirt, through a touch or a look? One prevailing medical theory held that certain stagnant environments, like those on a ship, emitted noxious smells that caused disease in humans. Something, it was believed, really was in the air. As members of Anson's squadron became sick, the officers and surgeons roamed the decks, sniffing out potential culprits: foul bilge, mouldy sails, rancid meat, human sweat, rotten timber, dead rats, piss and excrement, unwashed livestock, dirty breath. The fetidness had unleashed a plague of bugs, one so biblical that it was unsafe, as Milchon noted, for a man to open his mouth for fear of having them fly down his throat. Some crew members carved wooden boards into makeshift fans. These, a certain number of men, were employed to wave backwards and forwards in order to agitate the infected air, an officer recalled. Captain Murray and the other senior officers held an emergency conference with Anson. Bulkley was not included. There were certain rooms where he wasn't allowed. He soon learned that the officers had debated how to let in more air below decks. Anson ordered the carpenters to cut 6 additional openings in the hull of each man of war, just above the waterline. Still, the plague accelerated, with scores more infected. Ettrick and other doctors stationed in the sick bays grew overwhelmed. Tobias Smollett, whose picaresque novel The Adventures of Roderick Random drew on his experiences as a naval surgeon's mate during the war against Spain, wrote of an epidemic: "I was much less surprised that people should die on board than that any sick person should recover. Here I saw about 50 miserable, distempered wretches suspended in rows, so huddled upon another and deprived of the light of day as well as the fresh air, breathing nothing but their own excrements and diseased bodies. As a sick patient fought for his life on the lonely seas, far from home, his mates might visit him, holding a lantern over his vacant eyes and trying to cheer him up. Or perhaps, as a chaplain on a man of war described it, dropping silent tears on him, or in the most heart-rending accents, calling him. And then there's a burial at sea, and it moved me. Yet that was horrible, but it really moved me of the humanity that people still showed, that emotion for the team, because that was the only way the ship could keep going, because every man was absolutely part of keeping every other man alive. So I suppose I've only just thought that the call, every man for himself, it actually really does portend the end of everything. But anyhow, I hope that gives you a flavour. I found that was quite typical of the way that there would be things in brackets that perhaps you think, well, yeah, we didn't really need to know the etymology. But genuinely getting across the horror. And if you're born in Portsmouth, there tends to be a sort of notion that it was all sort of sea shanties and everything. Maybe because you learn all this stuff going to the Victory at primary school, so they keep the horror from you. But I found it fascinating, and I hope you did too.
Well, thank you for that, Susie. That was great.
I rather enjoyed sort of nattering in the kitchen, actually. It was like real life.
Real life, absolutely. Well, I didn't get a cup of coffee there. I don't know what's happened to the hospitality around here.
Well,
anyway.
You know, time marches on. So if you didn't catch any of the titles, because they sound really exciting this month, they will, of course, be on the website.
They will. So, and as usual, if you've missed any part of it, or you want to listen to any of the previous 42 editions of Talking Books. Mm-hmm. You can find them on Spotify or where you usually get your podcasts.
Brilliant. Tim, thanks for coming out all this way to Sheet.
Thanks, Susie. Bye.
Bye.
Shine Radio, made in Petersfield by
Andy,
Kirsty,
Amy,
Dougie,
and you.
To join us, email team@shineradio.uk or call or WhatsApp us on 01730 555 500.
Join our team and make it shine at the radio station made by you.
You make it shine.